Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 108, recorded Thursday, August 11th, 2011. It'd take a miracle. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code KIKI8. This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, and I'm Dr. Kiki. This is episode 108 of our show, and today is, as usual, going to be another fantastic conversation. I hope you really enjoy it, and I hope you're ready to dig in, get down, get dirty, because we are going to be evaluating the science of miracles this week. We're going to be talking with our guest, Dr. Indre Viscontis. She's a neuroscientist and the host of The Miracle Detectives on the Oprah Winfrey Network. But first, a few science headlines. A belt of antimatter has been discovered around our planet by the Pamela satellite, otherwise known as Payload for Antimatter, Matter Exploration, and Light Nuclei Astrophysics. Consisting of antiprotons and analogous to the Van Allen belts, which consist of trapped normal matter, the belt is held in place by Earth's magnetic field, where the antimatter particles remain until they encounter real matter particles and annihilate themselves in a flash of light. Kepler scientists reported finding a planet of the darkest black orbiting an alien star. The planet TRES-2b reflects only 1% of the sunlight that hits it, or the starlight that hits it, due to its superheated, light-absorbing atmosphere. Think of the blackest black you can, and that's still probably not as black as this planet. Martian rover Opportunity reached the rim of the giant Martian crater Endeavor, where it will look at old Martian rocks. NASA scientists hope to peer into a time during Mars's past when the conditions on the surface of the planet were much milder and possibly involved lots of water. A new stick-on tattoo is going to be reported this week in the journal Science. While that might seem like a strange place to report a tat, in this case, it's perfectly understandable, as the tattoos are really microsensors in tattoo clothing. Called an epidermal electronic system, the sensors are thinner than a human hair and sensitive enough to monitor heart rate, brain waves, and muscle activity. Researchers at MIT's Lincoln Laboratory have designed a drug that has the potential to cure any virus, even the common cold. The paper published in PLOS One reported that the drug was tested on 15 viruses and effectively eradicated all of them by killing cells that had been infected. Molecular entomologists showed that female mosquitoes can't tell the difference between male mosquitoes who have sperm and those that don't. The research suggests that spermless male mosquitoes might be a viable method for eradicating and limiting the spread of malaria. And birds get more and more like people every day. Scientists studying Nazca boobies discovered that young birds who were abused by adults went on to later abuse young birds as adults. Violence begets violence, even in birds. Stop the cycle. Validating what chimpanzee researchers in the field already knew about chimp behavior, primatologists at Emory University showed that chimps share. Previous laboratory research had been unable to elicit generous behaviors in chimps, leading researchers to think that they couldn't act like humans do. But this study used a more natural experimental paradigm and got chimps to share with their partners between 53 to 67% of the time. And that's the news headlines for today. And I'd like to take this moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. Something that we all can appreciate. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac, your PC, your iPad. There's an iPad app. You can even watch on your iPhone or your Android device. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox or PS3, Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. And if you have something like a Roku box or an Apple TV, those devices, which are inexpensive and easy to use, can also let you watch on your TV. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can start watching the shows or movies on any one device and then finish on a different one. Whatever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time you want as well. But you can try Netflix today for 30 days for free if you go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. That's Netflix, netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. And we thank Netflix for their support of Twit and hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. So getting back to the show and the reason that we're here, we're here to talk about miracles. It's not a miracle that we're here to talk about it, but we do have a guest thanks to the miracle of technology. How many times am I going to misuse this word? According to her website, Dr. Indre Viscontis holds a Master of Music degree from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA, and a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Toronto. She's published more than 30 original papers and chapters related to the neural basis of memory and creativity. Indre is also the co-star in 6 episodes of a new television show called Miracle Detectives, which aired in the winter of 2011 on the Oprah Winfrey Network. Indre, thank you so much for joining me today on the Science Hour.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I have a personal interest in your scientific interests. I'm also interested in memory, although I studied it in birds as opposed to humans. To get started, I'd love to hear a little bit about your personal history and what got you into science and into studying memory and creativity.
Sure. I mean, for me, it all started when I was a child and I learned about psychology and how just there are so many things that we don't know about the brain. And when I went to college, I decided to become a psych major. And I had a couple of really great mentors at the University of Toronto. One was Dr. Morris Moscovich and the other was Dr. Mary Pat McAndrews. And both of them study memory. But what's really interesting about their work is that they study autobiographical memory, which is the type of memory that we use to remember things in our lives. And I did a couple of projects with them that really opened up my mind to how, when you're a scientist, you're writing the textbook, you're making the new discoveries, and you don't just take for granted what someone else is telling you. And that really resonated with me. I was always an independent child, and the idea that I could go out and make new discoveries and be the one writing the textbooks was really appealing.
Textbooks, right?
Yeah, exactly. I actually published my first paper with Morris and Mary Pat, and it was on autobiographical memory in patients with temporal lobe epilepsy, because the seizures start in the part of the brain, the hippocampus, which we know is really important for autobiographical memory. So that's how I started, and at the same time, all the while that I was growing up, my mother, who's a conductor, always encouraged me to pursue musical interests. And I always wanted to be an opera singer. I was in my first opera with the Canadian Opera Company when I was 11. I played an altar boy in Tosca, and it was just the most amazing experience. And so I continued to train throughout college, but I felt that I needed to get a real degree in order to make it in this world. And then after college, I went off to London, because, as one does, to be an opera singer. And and so I worked as an usher at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden, and I worked for a couple of newspapers to make ends meet. And I realized very quickly that in your 20s, even though you have a college degree, you're not really qualified to do very much, at least not very much that's very interesting. So I figured I'd have to continue to develop myself in my 20s if I wanted to have a career in something fulfilling. And I had gotten into UCLA, and they have a really wonderful program in cognitive neuroscience, which at the time was just this like really great buzzword, you know, the idea that we could study cognition, which is, you know, thinking and memory and all these fuzzy parts of the brain mm-hmm. that up until then really weren't, you know, it wasn't really cool to study that because it wasn't quite rigorous enough from a scientific perspective. But by the time I started my PhD, cognitive neuroscience was really coming into its own as a solid field. It was the advent of neuroimaging techniques like functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, and MEG and PET scans and such. So it was an exciting time. And so I decided to go to UCLA and do my PhD. And there I continued to study memory, autobiographical memory, but also some reasoning studies and how reasoning changes as we get older. And at UCLA, I had the really wonderful opportunity to actually record directly from neurons in the hippocampus, from awake behaving patients with epilepsy. There are very few places in the world where we can do that. Usually direct recordings from neurons come from animals because it's very invasive, obviously. Mm-hmm. And if you do get to direct record from patients with epilepsy, often you either record just from ensembles of neurons, so sort of large potentials, large groups of brain cells, or only from the surface of the cortex and not deep in the brain, which is where the hippocampus lies.
Yeah, it's buried in the brain, basically.
It is, yeah. Yeah. It's sort of this old reptilian structure that's mm-hmm. sort of right sort of in between your ears, but also buried in, and it's very hard to access. It's hard to access with fMRI as well because it's so close to the ears, right. which have, you know, these holes that allow you to hear, and that sometimes blows out the signal because there's too much of a difference. So anyway, so it was really exciting to be able to study single neurons in the hippocampus and in patients with epilepsy. And to this day, I'm still working on two papers right now that I started at UCLA, and I graduated in 2006. So those data were collected a long time ago, but the data set was so rich that, you know, we continued to mine it, and it's really kind of exciting. So that was my experience in neuroscience. And the bug bit me about, you know, studying the brain and studying things like autobiographical memory, already I felt like that was a little bit fringe. But since then, the study of consciousness and of the self and identity and all these other topics that were really kind of taboo and wishy-washy when I was an undergrad have now become, you know, seriously researched topics. And so I think it's a really exciting time in neuroscience. And so I've continued to keep my foot in there, even while I've pursued these other artistic and, you know, media related careers.
I think that's really, really great. Being able to straddle both is difficult, but rewarding in the end, being able to continue. And, you know, currently I've seen that you're doing work at UCSF. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing now?
Sure. So after I finished my PhD at UCLA, I got a postdoc position at UCSF part-time, because at the same time I was doing my master's in music at the San Francisco Conservatory. And I wanted to work at UCSF because one of the neurologists there who directs the Memory and Aging Center, his name is Dr. Bruce Miller. He was one of the few people that studied the paradoxical facilitation of skills or creativity in patients with neurodegeneration. So sometimes patients who suffer from dementia that's not Alzheimer's disease, but related or very much like Alzheimer's disease in that it's progressive and it happens generally after middle age. Sometimes they lose their ability to communicate verbally. And in a subset of these patients, he noticed that they actually began to express themselves using art and other creative means. So these patients, they have what's called semantic dementia, and they actually lose concepts progressively. So, for example, the very first signs of the disease, they'll have trouble remembering the words for exemplars in a category. So let's say we're talking about the category birds, they might, you know, not be able to distinguish an eagle from a hawk. And as the disease progresses, they'll lose their ability to distinguish a bird from another animal, and then an animal from a human or from any other living thing. And so their vocabulary will become impoverished. And eventually they'll just describe the world using things like this and that and there. Not very nonspecific. But what's interesting is in a subset of these patients, they began to paint, or they had very visual pursuits. So, for example, they love putting jigsaw puzzles together. A lot of them garden. Many of them make sculptures, or they collect coins. And so he wrote first about these patients and how it's paradoxical that, you know, they're undergoing these major degenerative brain changes, and yet there's something positive that's coming out of it, because the new activity that they're doing, not only are they really enjoying it in a way that they didn't before the disease hit, but sometimes they actually get critical acclaim for the pieces that they're producing, because they seem to be more creative than when they were completely healthy. And it's a complicated story, but to me that was really fascinating. And I always, you know, one of the things that I've struggled with a lot is that I feel that there's a lot of ageism in our culture, that we look upon the elderly as infirm and weak and disabled. And for whatever reason, maybe it was because I was very close to my grandparents, that always bothered me. And And so to be able to work with a patient population in which there's something that's positive, and you know, you can kind of then see how, if you continue down that road of studying what's positive with brain changes, we might actually be able to fight some of this ageism and see aging as just another stage and not necessarily a deterioration. And that's one of the other sort of goals of the Memory and Aging Center. So I started working with him there, and we've just, in this past winter, we published a big study of our findings. My job was really to look more rigorously at what is it about these patients that might lead them to be creative visually. And so I wanted to know, why is it that they have all these activities that are sort of highly visual and sort of that they're interested, seems like, in a complex visual scene that for the rest of us maybe isn't that exciting. So I had them do a number of tasks, but one of the tasks that I had them do was to search for a target, say like the letter N, amongst a series of distractors, say like the letter O or the letter K. And this is called a visual search task, and it was pioneered by a woman named Ann Treisman in the 80s. It's one of the first tasks that we use to recognize that there are different sort of visual search processes that we use. And one of them is parallel, in the sense that it doesn't matter how many distractors you put in front of a person, the target letter will pop out. And the reason it pops out is because it has some feature that's independent of all the other letters. So if you think about, if you just imagine in your head a whole series of T's on a computer screen, and then all of a sudden there's an O in the middle of it, and your job is to find the O, it doesn't matter how many T's I put on the screen, the O is going to pop out. Right. Because it's circular and it's curved. The same will happen if the O or the T that you're looking for is in a different color from all the other distractors. It'll pop out. But if there's a conjunction of features that you're looking for, so for example, if you're looking for a T among L's, you need to search every single item, you know, serially, one by one, in order to find that target. It's like the Where's Waldo books. The reason the Where's Waldo books are hard is because Waldo shares a lot of features with all the other people in the book, and the colors and the you know, shapes, everything. It's a very complex scene. And we noticed that our patients are actually very good at finding Waldo, and they're very good at know, doing these jigsaw puzzles. And so I wondered if maybe there was something enhanced in their ability to find a target amongst distractors, even when there is this conjunction of features, even when they have to do a serial search.
And right. So is there something happening in their brain that's, is their visual processing slightly different? Is it changed in some way? Do we looking for colors in a particular way? Are these the kinds of questions you're interested in?
Yeah. Exactly. And one of the exciting things about the conjunction of features task is that it requires binding two features or a set of features together. And binding is something that is really mysterious about our brain. So how is it that even though different parts of our brain, like say our visual cortex, process different aspects of the world? So for example, there's one area that processes color, there's another area that processes edges, and yet we perceive the world as one perception. We don't see it necessarily as a set of colors overlaid onto a set of edges, even though that's the way our brains are wired. So the binding problem, which the brain obviously solves because we perceive a whole object, is one of the holy grails of neuroscience. Is how does the brain do that, right? How do these processes that seem to be happening in parallel in the brain create a single percept? And so what we found was that in our patients, not only were they able to find the target more quickly, suggesting that they sort of were hyperbinding, but the area of the brain that correlated with this ability is the same area of the brain that we see often is affected in people with synesthesia. So synesthesia is
interesting.
Is this binding of different perceptual domains, right? So people, for example, the most common type of synesthesia is called grapheme color synesthesia, and that's when people see letters and numbers in colors. And so, you know, when they see the letter C, it's always the same color. And so anyway, that same, and sort of the best hypothesis of why this happens is that, you know, there seems to be kind of a cross-wiring in the brain. And we saw that in the same region of the brain, which is kind of at the intersection of, you know, the visual and the attentional cortices, that same part of the brain was sort of larger in the patients that did particularly well on the task, even though they, you know, they're having degeneration in another part of the brain. So it's something to do with the way the brain is plastic. It's dynamic. It's not a machine in the sense that you have a certain number of parts and then those parts work together. And like your car, you know, it doesn't really change. But the brain changes all the time depending on how we use it. So if one part of the brain degenerates, in fact, now we know what's happening is that other parts of the brain are changing too. They're compensating maybe, or they're, you know, behaving in a different way because the inputs are different. And so this is what we're seeing in these patients, is that as this rewiring is happening, they are, you know, they have this sort of hyperbinding in this part of the brain. So it's kind of exciting.
That's really interesting. I just wonder in terms of perception and how these individuals perceive the world. Do they perceive the change in the way that they view the world? And just imagining what it must be like to, you know, when you've had a complete rewiring, you know, how it is to see through those eyes.
Yeah, I mean, that was really what drew me to do this study, is that I wanted to figure out what it was that they were, what were they seeing? And so, one of the things we did is we tracked their eye movements while they were looking at not only our task, but also just regular images. So we showed them pictures of art. We showed them pictures of their own art. We showed them pictures of landscapes, boring pictures of just, you know, random things. And it turns out these patients really, I don't know what they're seeing, but they're not seeing what we're seeing, because what they're focusing on is very different. Like there's this one kind of canonical image that I'll never forget, where it's just a set of train tracks going out into the distance, right? So, you know, you just see like train tracks and they end sort of at the end of the image. And all of us, no matter, I mean, whether you have Alzheimer's disease or you're healthy, or, you know, whether it's you or me or you're 85, we all look to see where the train's coming, you know, from.
Right.
We look to that sort of that the end of that perspective. And the patients with somatic dementia don't. They don't care. They look at the gravel. They look at the trees. They look at all kinds of other things, but they don't, they look you know, that doesn't, that they don't care about where the train is coming from. So, you know, to me, that was really interesting. And I think that's one of the things that is really remarkable about the art that they produce, is that you finally get an idea of maybe what it is that they're experiencing. And their artwork generally is devoid of sort of symbolic content or verbal representation, but it's very vivid in terms of color and geometry. A lot of their paintings are very, very intricate from a geometric point of view. So I would guess, for example, that they would relate more to, say, a Mondrian painting or a Kandinsky than, say, you know, somebody who's more realistic, like a Van Gogh or something. But, you know, I don't know. They also found Starry Night really interesting, I think, because of all the swirls and I think that's, to me, one of the one of the reasons I sort of got really into neuroscience was because I'd read a lot of Oliver Sacks, and right. He really humanizes neurology and patients, and he talks about, in his books, what's so remarkable is how he finds what's interesting and what's positive and what's just enlightening about what these patients are going through. Instead of just describing a syndrome, he describes the individual. And so I feel that the work that I've been doing with Bruce Miller is the closest I've ever come to that, is to try to really kind of understand and marvel at what's magnificent about the brain rather than just bemoan what's lost when things go awry.
This is really just so interesting to me. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or a blog, optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. So whatever right end of the spectrum you're on, you can still use Squarespace. Hundreds of design templates to choose from. You can customize them to fit your needs. There are iPhone and iPad apps if you want to update things on the go, not sitting at a desktop. There are online resources and a special support team to give you the help you need 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's an all-inclusive service that includes modules to help build your website, website tracking so you know how many times your site is viewed, and permission access handling, as well as cloud architecture for speed and site stability. Use Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com. Sign up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just try it out and start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, use the offer code KIKI8. And get 10% off for 6 months. That's right, 10% off for 6 months. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code KIKI8, KIKI8. Now back to the show. I'm speaking with Dr. Indre Viscontis, and she is a cognitive neuroscientist as well as one of the hosts of The Miracle Detectives, which is on the Oprah Winfrey Network, or at least it was on the Oprah Winfrey Network this winter. We're talking about the brain and the research that she's been doing, but it's time to talk about studying miracles.
Yep.
How did you get involved in The Miracle Detectives? How did you go from neuroscience and opera? Neuroscience and opera to asking questions about miracles.
You know, it really feels like one of those moments in your life that I don't really have an answer for you, except to say exactly how it happened, which was one day I was checking my UCSF email account and I saw this email saying, you know, we've come across your website and we're looking for someone to host this show. Would you be interested? And, you know, I immediately thought it was spam and I just thought, okay, this is a complete scam. But I had just signed on with an on-camera television agent because I had felt that one of my strengths in science and in opera is that I'm able to perform, and that, you know, I hope I'm somewhat articulate, and that's one of the things that I felt was one of my strengths. And so I wanted to use it in a way to bring science and bring some of the ideas that we've been working on at UCSF to a larger public. And so I sent this email off to my agent, and, you know, she said, well, let me check it out. And she came right back and said, look, this is one of the biggest production companies in LA. You should definitely audition, and you should definitely, you know, see what it's all about. So I did. And we was four rounds of auditions because they had lots of candidates. And one of the things that really sold me on the show from the beginning was that it was sort of like a modern day X-Files, except all of the cases that we were going to study were going to be positive outcomes. So people whose lives had been changed for the better, and that's what we were going to really look into. X-Files was my favorite show when I was in college, and I love all kinds of mysteries, and you know, I read a lot of novels, and the idea that there's something unknown that, you know, we can learn more about is really appealing to me. I mean, that's one of the reasons I went into science. It's also right. One of the reasons I love opera. I mean, the stories are so convoluted and unpredictable and interesting.
So for those of you who have not seen The Miracle Detectives or and want an idea of what the show is about, there's a clip that we've gotten from Indre's website of the show. It's a show reel. It includes some interview material that has Oprah. So now I can say that Oprah has been on the Science Hour. But without further ado, let's watch the clip.
This is one of my favorite new shows on the OWN channel. Randall Sullivan and Indre Viscontis, the hosts of Miracle Detectives, are here.
Two investigators will scour the earth to uncover mysteries that transcend logic.
I'm Dr. Indre Viscontis. I'm a scientist. Before I call something a miracle, I need to consider all of the facts. Some people might call me a skeptic.
One, a believer. The other, a scientist in search for truth.
Are you a scientist?
I am. Yeah, I have a degree in neuroscience.
Okay, and do you believe in miracles?
I think that if you're going to say something definitely is evidence for divine intervention or the supernatural, then that requires pretty extraordinary evidence.
Okay.
I've been reading a book about a family who, 10 years ago, believed that their 2-year-old son, James, had the reincarnated soul of a World War II fighter pilot. Today, he no longer recalls memories from World War II, but the evidence of his past life is so strange that we have to investigate it. I studied how memories are formed in the brain for my PhD at UCLA, and the idea that memories could be transferred after death is very hard for me to believe.
Okay, so how do you explain that little boy knowing about all that?
Well, you know, I think children say the darndest things. I think that it's really hard to interpret a child's behavior.
They say the darndest things and they name, you know, fighter ships and...
Well, I think in some cases they do. In this
well, that
case...
is the darndest thing, would you say?
Yeah, it is surprising.
Which is a tough nut to
yeah, oh my goodness.
But this particular child, before he started having the nightmares, spent 3 hours in the room of a Kavanaugh flight museum surrounded by World War II planes. He wore out his DVD of the Blue Angels. This is not a child that has just a cursory interest in planes. He wore out a DVD. I mean, how many times do you have to watch a DVD to wear it out? And that's why I think that, you know, often we misinterpret.
Well, that's why this is such a great show, because you are a hard nut to crack.
Yes, she is.
Really, yes, really.
Since we can't see Tiffany's stigmata in person, I think the photographs she provided us are my best source of information. In each of the photographs that I see, the blood is either fairly minimal or it's coagulated and gotten this very dark color, which suggests it's been around for a while. So it's not really consistent with the idea that the blood kept flowing, you know, kind of incessantly for a long period of time. I really feel that if we were able to see the future, the world would be a very different place. It's hard for me to reconcile the fact that so many things happened to us that if we knew that they were going to happen to us, we would behave differently. If the job here is to prove one way or another whether that construction worker exists or, you know, whether it was in John's imagination or whether he was sent from God, there are things we can look into, but fundamentally, you know, there's going to be an element of mystery. My studies in neuroscience have given me a realistic perspective on how our minds work. Seeing into the future or seeing things that aren't actually visible, I think is a function of fantasy or imagination. In neuroscience research, there's no credible evidence that these types of powers, ESP or clairvoyance, actually exist. I can't completely rule out the idea that it's a hallucination. It is not up to the medical profession or science as a whole to try to make a judgment as to the reality of a person's experience.
I love that. I think that I think that you present science very well, the scientific perspective. Was that difficult to do?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to watch it too. Yeah, I think the most difficult thing for scientists on television is to be is to not talk too much and not to try to cover too many things. And television really is about sound bites. And I got better and better as the show progressed, to bring my ideas down into a sound bite. But that's still very hard for scientists because we have so many caveats and, you know, it's very rare that we come out and say, well, we definitely know that X is the case. I mean, usually we say, well, it's unlikely that Y is the case.
Right.
I think that that's one of the things that makes it particularly challenging. But in this show, my job really was to try to see or to try to, I guess, investigate whether there was evidence of the supernatural. And that's a much easier thing for a scientist to investigate because that's a pretty extraordinary thing.
Right.
And it requires an extraordinary piece of evidence. And so if all the evidence that you have can be explained using a natural explanation, then from the perspective of science, you've done your job and there is no need to suggest that there is some supernatural force. Now, that's a hard thing to tell someone who believes that they have proof of divine intervention in their lives.
Yeah, and Oprah looked pretty upset with you in that clip.
Yeah,
she
wanted
to believe that some boy.
It actually surprised me because, you know, here it was the first time I was meeting, you know, essentially my boss, right? Oprah was my boss and, you know, she really grilled me, in front of her audience, but I also could see where she was coming from. I mean, often the explanations that we give as scientists don't feel quite as, powerful as the idea that, you know, there's some kind of supernatural thing going on to the layperson. For the scientist, you know, most of us are skeptical by nature in the sense that we understand that there are a lot of things about the world that we don't understand. And just because we don't understand it doesn't mean that there is some kind of odd explanation for it. It just means we haven't gotten there yet. So I think we're pretty comfortable as scientists with the unknown. And without having to fill the unknown with the divine or some other kind of, you know, idea. But I think the vast majority of people, particularly in this country, are very uncomfortable with the unknown, and that the idea that there is a God out there that looks after them and that acts directly in their lives is much more comforting and much more powerful than the idea that nature is chaotic and often things do happen by coincidence, and that's normal and that's okay. And we do expect the world to give us unexpected events just by coincidence.
Yeah, as a brain scientist and learning and wanting to understand how the brain works and how we perceive the world, that's got to be a fascinating difference. The difference between people who appreciate the scientific perspective of uncovering the coincidences in the chaos versus the feeling of satisfaction and fulfillment that you get from believing in a God.
Absolutely. And, you know, I learned a lot about social psychology and the way that we are sort of, you know, torn apart by or the way that our beliefs really shape what we perceive and what we expect to experience. I didn't know as much about social psychology as I do now when I started the show, and I had to do a lot of reading and a lot of, you know, I had to really, brush up really quickly. And one thing that I learned very quickly was that we're all susceptible to what's called the confirmation bias, which is the way that we hypothesis test in the world, or the way that we gather evidence. Our natural tendency is to look for bits of evidence that confirm what we already believe, instead of the way science is set up, which is really to look at evidence that disconfirms a hypothesis or, So it's an unnatural kind of way of going about life. And so a lot of times the evidence that people would bring to me was confirmatory of what they believed. And when I would say, well, that's all fine and good, but let's look at some disconfirming evidence, or let's set up the experiment so that we at least have a chance of disconfirming the evidence, that wasn't very satisfactory to them, wasn't very satisfying. So my job was always, I felt, to try to mimic the situation as much as I could, and you know, control the environment as much as one could, even though a lot of these were sort of single case experiences, and see how outside of the realm of possibility or of sort of what you would expect that particular event was. So, for example, in that the case of that child who his parents reported that, you know, he had all of this knowledge that he shouldn't have had about World War II, including personal knowledge of the family of the person whose soul they felt was reincarnated in the little boy. Like, for example, mm-hmm. the fact that that person had a sister and her name was Anne, and so on. And so my job was really to see, you know, how abnormal is his behavior. And so the parents would say, but look, you know, he knew the word natoma, and he, you know, knew what a drop tank was on a plane then when he was 3 years old. And, you know, I didn't even know what a drop tank was on a plane when he told me what it was. And right. And so I was sort of try to figure out, you know, how abnormal is that? You know, how many, is it really that no kids who are three know that word? And is there something about the little boy's experience, like something that he was exposed to, that would make it more likely for him to have learned that word? So one of the experiments I set up, for example, was to have the similar aged boys play with an airplane, because one of the pieces of evidence that his parents gave me was that the first time he went to an air show and saw an airplane, he did a pre-flight check. So, you know, they watched him walk around the airplane and, you know, check all the different aspects of the plane that a pilot does, checks before he gets into the plane to fly it. And they thought this was really odd. How could he possibly know what a pre-flight check was? And so I had a bunch of kids play with a plane to see whether a pilot instructor would interpret their behavior as being that of a person doing a pre-flight check, or if that really was completely outside of the realm of normal childhood play. And out of my three children, one of them did a pretty convincing pre-flight check. And you know, his dad's like, you know, he's never been next to a plane before. And it just turns out that it's kind of a natural way of exploring a plane. You know, you go clockwise around the plane and you look at the, you know, you kick the tire and you look under the wing and you, you know, play with the rudder. And then you go, you know, it's kind of, it seemed to me that it wasn't that extraordinary. And so the fact that out of, you know, you could throw three children in front of a plane and one of them, so one out of three, shows this behavior, makes it not very extraordinary. I mean, the other two kids were completely different. One of them ran away screaming right away. And the other one, like, you know, sort of, you know, knocked on the plane a bit and then ran away and played with a different toy in the hangar. So, you know, there's a big variety in childhood behavior. And that's kind of the point that I was trying to make with Oprah, is that, look, you know, we have a term for this. It's kids say the darndest things. So we know that kids surprise us all the time with what it is that they say. Right. And it's because their world is so different from our world. Their brains are so different in terms of the development, especially under age three, which is when the majority of these sort of reincarnated or recovered memories seem to come about, right? That when these kids are reported as having these recovered memories from a past life, they're generally around, you know, 2.5 to 3, which is the time in a child's life where they're finally learning to communicate. Yep. But they also have a lot of trouble telling fantasy from reality. So that was sort of the way that I approached it. And, but for a lot of people, it was very hard for them to accept, given all this evidence confirming the hypothesis that this was the reincarnated soul of a World War II pilot. And when I would show, well, you know, this isn't that extraordinary, and maybe that, you know, can be explained by that, that wasn't nearly as satisfying to them as this global theory that, okay, this is a World War II pilot reincarnated in this boy, and that explains all of the evidence. And I think that that's one of the things that made these miracle stories really fascinating to me, is that, you know, you can, if you start with the perspective of trying to confirm your hypothesis, you can gather a lot of information and a lot of data. But that's not how science works, you know, as we know.
Yeah. Did you find that there was a lot of, pushback from these individuals who were confirming their bias in the evidence that they were looking at, that, when you came to them and said, look, I'm disconfirming what you think, was there a difficulty there because what you were saying was not satisfying?
Well, I mean, the crew was pretty sensitive to the fact that we didn't want to go back in. They didn't send me back to the person's home to, you know, tell them that I think they're wrong. And a lot of the times, you know, I don't think they're wrong. I just think that their interpretation of what happened is not the same as mine. And I think that what I was struck by, first of all, was how nice everybody was that we met along the way. I mean, in general, people in America, at least that I met through this show, are very nice and are very polite and are very open. And the fact that they would let us come in and they would tell us these intimate stories about their lives was, I felt really privileged to hear these stories. And so I really didn't think it was my place to be sort of combative and say, look, you know, what you believe, you know, is I don't believe that. it was a difficult position to be in, especially me having some clinical experience and I often am very empathized with the people that I talk to, but there were moments when it was hard for me to, you know, on camera, you know, say, look, I think this person is wrong. But I also knew that was my job and that, I think there's more good to come from understanding the truth of a situation than even if that means, tarnishing or, you know, hurting someone's beliefs. Because if we find what's true, then we can apply that truth or we can apply that knowledge to all kinds of different cases. So, you know, let's take the example of a person who believes that they were cured from cancer because, you know, they ate some kind of a supplement and now so if we find out that there's something in that supplement that really has curative properties, then we can apply that, to everybody that has that cancer. On the other hand, if that person is eating that supplement because they believe that supplement is curing them and all you're seeing really is a placebo effect, and as a result, they're eschewing traditional treatments that we know can be effective, that's really dangerous. And for them to go around and tell all their friends that, you know, they were cured by this supplement, and then that sort of spreads. I mean, that's part of the anti-vaccine movement. It's very dangerous. Children have died in California. Like 11 children died last year of whooping cough. And it was eradicated. You know, it's completely ridiculous. And so in those cases, I feel like it's my job as a scientist to say, look, you know, you're believing something that's not true. And not only that, but it can be harmful. And even though it's going to be difficult for you to, accept that what you believe is not true, I need to tell you this because it's going to help you in the end, or it's going to help your children in the end. I was surprised definitely at some of the negative reactions that I got, because I consider myself to be a pretty, I mean, I know I can be outspoken and I can be a bit aggressive. But in general, I think of myself, you know, in my own self-identity as a pretty nice person, and that, you know, I'm not like a bulldog and I'm not, you know, mean or unfair. And yet a lot of times I could see that that's how people perceived me, especially in cases where I felt that the person was overstating whatever it is that they experienced for personal gain, and a lot of times it wasn't financial, but it was like, you know, they became the pillar of their community because they had experienced this miracle, or so people who I felt were kind of exploiting their experience were the ones who were the most hostile to me,
that damaged their reputation. Yeah,
absolutely.
In terms of your history, studying memory, we know that memory, we've learned through scientific studies that memory is very malleable. Did you see evidence of that in any of the so-called miracles that you came up against, or that you investigated?
Evidence of that in every miracle I investigated. I mean, there's no question that the way that you remember something is influenced by what you believe. So a lot of times people would report things that happened. And when I would look at either the police report or I would look at what they originally had said, you know, before they had thought it was a miracle, they didn't match up. And, you know, that's not surprising if you're a memory researcher, because you know that your current mood, your current beliefs, the amount of times and the way that you've told a memory, a story of a memory, all of those things affect the way that you remember something and the actual experience of remembering that. And the fact that you're very confident that what you remember, you think that it's really based on truth, that confidence has really nothing to do with how true your memory is. We know that you can be very, very confident that that's something that you remember actually happened, and it could have absolutely not happened in that way. That's just the confidence of your memory is not a good indicator of its truth. So I encounter that in every single interview. And I try to be very objective, and I try to not ask leading questions, and I try to take down as much of the story as I could without, you know, asking certain, you know, questions that then would steer them in one direction or another. And I really didn't take their experience or their story at face value. My co-host, on the other hand, for him, that was the most important part of the story. Is you know, he judged whether something was a miracle primarily on whether or not he felt that the person was being genuine about reporting their experience. So already from the outset, we had very different views of sort of how to go about investigating these stories. He's a journalist, so that kind of makes sense, because his job is to go after and get, you know, the story from the person's experience, from the person's mouth. Whereas I'm a scientist, so I like to make generalities over a not large number of experiences.
The subjective versus the objective. So he's looking at it from the very subjective personal story level, and you would be looking at it from the, microscope or the magnifying glass objective level of the scientist.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I think that there's room for both, except that I also think that if you're trying to evaluate the truth of something, the objective, is going to have to be weighed more heavily than the subjective. The subjective is where we can learn about the human experience in a way that can be very enlightening. And I think that's really where art comes in. And, I think the subjective experience is a really wonderful and important part of our lives, but it's not going to tell us a lot about objective reality. And if you're trying to make a claim about the objective reality and your claim is this is evidence of the supernatural, then you need to stay within the objective realm, because that's what you're trying to, you know, make other people believe.
Was it ever really hard to stay skeptical? I mean, to stay in your scientist hat and but did you ever just want to give up and just be like, okay, fine, you're right, it was a miracle. I'm the silly one, silly scientist, whatever.
it was frustrating at times, because I often felt that I didn't have the right tools to investigate the experience, right? When something's happened and it happened a number of years ago and it only happened once, I mean, from the scientific perspective, it's very difficult to investigate. And so there were lots of times where I felt like, okay, you know what? I've come as far as I can in my investigation, and I can't go any further with this. On the other hand, I felt like in each one of the cases, there was something objective that I could look into. And that was exciting for me, because I learned a lot about, you know, all the different kind of mysterious things that go on in our world, and how many of them we actually know as scientists quite a bit about, you know, stigmata and, the appearance of holy oils and how they can be curative or not, the placebo effect and, you know, the power of belief and the power of optimism and the confirmation bias. There are definitely times where I felt like the burden of proof was put on me. You know, the people were saying, look, we know it's a miracle. You need to prove to us that it isn't. And that's backwards. Because the truth is that they need to prove to me that it is. And,
it's all perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Or not, you know, then, you know, there were times when I felt like I was happy to walk away and say, you know, you don't have to prove to me that this is a miracle, but then don't expect me to turn around and say that just because I can't explain it, it therefore must be a miracle. And so there, the frustrating parts of my being on the show, I think, really came from what I saw as a double standard. You know, it was that it wasn't, you know, they didn't necessarily, it didn't matter to them whether or not the proof was there. But if I came out and disproved it, or if I was, you know, making a claim, then, you know, I really had to sort of back it up. And so it taught me a lot about the way that people perceive science. And a lot of people, I felt, especially when the show is on the air, and it's actually airing in Asia starting in September. So I'm really excited to see how people in Asia are going to respond to it. Mm. You know, there's a lot of anger, and a lot of people said, oh, you know, she's so close-minded. She's made up her mind before she's even done the investigating. And that's not at all how I experienced it. You know, my subjective experience was that I came into each episode or each story, and there were 12 of them, thinking, oh my God, if this was true, how amazing would that be? I will win the Nobel Prize.
Right.
Or at least I will, you know, get one step closer to finding, you know, setting science in the direction towards a great discovery. And so I know I wanted each one of them to be inexplicable. I wanted to get to the end of the story and you know, throw my hands up in the air and say, I have no idea how that happened. And it turns out that in the vast majority of the cases, you know, I came up with a pretty plausible explanation. And, you know, that, there's some sort of professional satisfaction in that. But it's not nearly as satisfying as it would have been if I had just been blown away by something. I mean, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was evidence of the supernatural? I mean, that would just be like, that would be awesome.
But so far, no evidence. Was there anything that you walked away from and you went, that's could be evidence. This deserves further study. Let me call my scientist friends and say you should work on this.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I thought like, okay, I should call my scientist friends and say we need to work on this. But in no time did I feel that was because there was evidence that we wouldn't be able to eventually explain. I felt like it was worth looking into because, I mean, certainly the experiences that these people have had are really kind of unusual and very strong. And I feel like we need to learn a lot more about why is it that when you believe something, you know, sometimes you do get better, you know, and is it the placebo effect doesn't seem to me that it's explaining everything. I think that there's a lot of room there to try to understand, you know, when people have this sense of purpose, their lives do, you know, things do end up in a different direction. That's not to say that someone is or some entity is guiding them in that direction. I think that we were really banking on a second season, and in the second season, some of the bigger or more mysterious happenings were the ones that we were going to investigate, and they were going to be in Europe and in India, and we had all these plans. And so, you know, I really felt like this was just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we started out with these 12 cases, and now we're going to go off and get at the really, you know, mysterious phenomenon.
And that's not going to happen now, unfortunately. The show was canceled. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it wasn't renewed.
Wasn't renewed. Okay. Not officially canceled.
And it wasn't renewed on the Oprah Winfrey Network. You know, there's a possibility, of course, that a different network will pick it up. But I think given this, you know, given the way that television is these days and, you know, given the economy, it's unlikely that a show that was, you know, put on a network gets picked up by another network. That doesn't happen very often. And I think that there are things that we could have improved on the show. And if I were to produce a show like that, there are definitely things that I would do differently. For one, I would make the episodes one story per hour as opposed to two stories per hour, because there were way too many things that we had to cut out, both from the scientific side and from the spiritual side, that made the stories that so much more interesting. And it was a real shame because, you know, I felt like there were a lot of things on both sides that people would have found the stories more compelling. And So I think that that's one of the things. And I also think that we need to sort of rework the roles that the two co-hosts have, because it gets a little boring to have one person say, well, I think it's like this, and another person say, well, I think it's like that.
I know. You know, I don't. Okay, there we go.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and, you know, we'd get into some pretty heavy arguments. A lot of them were off camera, but, you know, so I think that there needs to be some changes happen there. But I do think that this people are fascinated by these stories. I think that there's room for this kind of exploration on television, and I think it's a great medium for it. And, you know, I hope that we get a chance to do it better.
Yeah, in terms of the programs that you did, did you leave? Do you think there might be miracles out there? Do you believe in miracles at all?
You know, it's funny because before I started this show, I believed in miracles more than I do now. And there's a part of me that's very sad about that, and I still kind of struggle with it because I do feel I'm suffering from the sadder but wiser phenomenon. On the other hand, I think that it's really kind of showed me how important it is to look at science as the unraveling of a mysterious phenomenons at multiple layers. So it's really renewed my love for science and for the idea of exploration and you know, trying to solve a mystery. Because, you know, each of these stories, you can look at them at so many different layers. And that's really what science does. Science is not just, oh, you know, we have one question, we'll answer it with one method. Science progresses by looking at the same question from multiple different methods and using, you know, many different experiments and looking at it at all kinds of different levels. And so you can learn so much more about the world using that perspective. And so, you know, now the way I approach the world is, instead of thinking like, oh, you know, isn't it sad that the evidence for the supernatural interacting in our lives is pretty weak. But I think, you know, there are so many things that I'm missing out if I'm just looking at the world from one perspective. You know, I need to, you know, if I'm experiencing, say, you know, the way the mind works, for example, you know, I want to learn about it from many, many different levels, and that there's an infinite amount of knowledge that I can gain by studying it from these different levels. And so that's much more exciting to me now. And, you know, so yeah, I think what it's done is really opened up, expanded my interests in science and maybe made me sort of less sure that everything's going to work out okay for me.
Exactly. Do you think that not to say stereotype, but the role that you played and how you were portrayed in Miracle Detectives, do you think that it does portray scientists in a good light? And do you think that for people who might not be exposed to science and what science is, do you think that it maybe gives people a better view of science?
I hope so. I mean, it's hard for me to be objective because, you know, Right. Not only am I watching myself, and it's very hard for me to do that, but also I know all the things that got cut out. And I worked very, very hard to put a warm and human face on science. And therefore not to just go out and say, oh, you know, be very aggressive and say, oh, well, you're clearly wrong or whatever. You know, I tried to really empathize with the people that we were talking to, by the same token, maintaining a pretty rigorous scientific standard. And I think that some episodes were better than others in terms of the way they were edited. There were a couple of moments where I really felt like, you know, my position was undermined because they edited something out. And once in a while, I felt like they manufactured an emotion that I really hadn't felt, that made me seem colder than I am. There's, you know, one case in particular where I just remember I watched it and I was just like, oh, you can see how they spliced it together to make me look like I'm, you know, angry because my experiment's not working out. Whereas it wasn't the case at all. My experiment worked perfectly.
Right. They you know? They splice it together. They add some dramatic music. They put in some kind of a they move the camera to like show a cat looking ominous. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the end, the people who are editing know much more about television and what makes a television show work than I do. And so I had to give them the benefit of the doubt that what they're doing is in the interest of keeping a show on the air that will then, you know, reach a lot of different people. And even if it means, I mean, you know, it's not a scientific study. I didn't have control over every aspect of the things that I was investigating.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, that's part of being on television. I felt for the most part they did a good job. Yeah, there were some moments where I felt like, you know, they chose snippets of me that weren't either, you know, didn't show me at my best or were much more polarizing than in other cases. But I never felt that they really misrepresented me, you know, for an entire episode. And they gave me a lot of airtime, which a lot of times in these kinds of shows, you know, the token scientist, you know, comes in at the end and, you know, gets 10 seconds. You know, I was talking to Michael Shermer, who was on the show, and he was telling me that a lot of the times when he's been on, you know, the Oprah show or Dr. Oz or whatever, like, you know, he gets edited out almost entirely. And, you know, other people who have a different perspective and get a lot more airtime. And I felt in this show that, I mean, yes, it was still Randall, my co-host, was one of the executive producers. So, you know, yes, mm-hmm. he did get more airtime than I did. But there are moments when they left me, you know, and I had some good points sometimes, and they left those in. You know, it's not like they totally cut it out. And so, you know, it's interesting. It's like my friends who watch the show think, oh, you know, you came out looking so much more interesting and smarter, and, you know, your points were much better. And then, you know, you read online people who are bigger fans of Randall saying, oh, Indre's so close-minded, and, you know, she doesn't know what she's talking about. But
once again, I think, confirmation bias, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But there were enough people, I think, that commented that I didn't know, you know, commented on our blog or on the web or whatever, that basically had no reason to like me. And in fact, were often people on the other side, you know, like this one guy I remember who said, you know, I'm a staunch Catholic and I believe in miracles. And I think what you did a really great job, because there are a lot of false prophets out there. And there are a lot of people that believe things that just aren't real. And, you know, searching for the truth is really important. And so those are the people that I felt like really warmed by their comments, because I felt like, okay, you know, if someone like that who comes to watch the show with the expectation that they're going to see something miraculous can turn around and say, you know, you did a good job of opening my mind, you know, my job's done.
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming to the end of the hour here, and I just want to thank you so much for joining me today. What are you doing next? Are you in the research lab working with your patients with dementia and creativity studies, or are we going to see you on TV anytime soon?
Well, as usual, I have a lot of projects going on. So I have a couple papers that I'm still working on, and some experiments at UCSF. But I also write a blog, and I've been working towards two different book projects. Neither of which I can really talk about, but both of which I think are really exciting. And they're both, geared towards a lay audience, not just neuroscientists or academics. And I'm really excited about those two projects, and they're kind of big. And, you know, at the same time, I've got a couple of one sheets out about different television shows that I want to do. And I've been building, you know, some opera chamber music performances in the next year. And so that's sort of my life is always been a series of projects. It's not necessarily going to be 40 years of doing the same thing over and over and over again. It's going to be, you know, 40, 50, hopefully 70 years of different projects. And so those are all the projects that I'm building.
And maybe the research that you're doing now will benefit you 70 years from now when you're doing projects.
I hope so. You know, a lot of the stuff that I'm working on now is I've always been interested in brain plasticity and the way that the brain is dynamic. And I'm working with Lumosity, which is this online brain training software company that And I think they're onto something, is that, you know, the way that you use your brain right now is going to affect how it's going to work in the future. So yeah. I love the idea of like neuro enhancement and looking at, you know, using what we know about science, not making claims that we can't stand behind, but really making strides in terms of managing our brains as opposed to just letting our brains manage us. And I think that's really exciting.
Very exciting. Thank you once again for joining me today. This has been a really interesting hour. And for anybody who is interested in finding out more about Indre and what she's up to, her website is indrevisconti.com. And you can get links to her blog there as well. And Twitter account is Indrevis, I-N-D-R-E-V-I-S, at Indrevis. That's right. Am I right there?
Yes. Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. I am Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Science Hour. And next week, we're going to be talking about the holographic universe with Dr. Rafael Bosso from UC Berkeley. I'm pretty excited about this one. The universe. Is it a hologram? Are we really living in a hologram? A 3D projection from a 2D screen? It doesn't make sense, but we'll find out more about it next week. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki. I'm also Dr. Kiki on Facebook, and my website is drkiki.tv. You can subscribe to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour in iTunes and find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki, K-I-K-I. And if you want to contact me to via email to ask a question, give feedback, suggest a guest, or send me a cool science video, you can email Dr. Kiki at drkiki.tv. I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. Remember, all I ask is just one little hour a week. And that 1 hour makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Thanks for watching. Now for your scientific meditation of the week.